This is a HeadGum Podcast.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Fake the Nation, episode 258.
Hello, hello. This is Fake the Nation, where we talk about news, we talk about politics, and where we marvel at ranked choice voting in New York City. Oh my God, I am your host, Nagin Farsad, and we made it through one round of votes. Now we're going to go through the rest of the ranks. It's going to take some time. And you know what? No one said democracy didn't need to take a little time. Sometimes democracy takes just a little time. It's okay. But today, we're going to talk about the Breathe Act and some other GOP shenanigans. And we'll also talk about how many friends you can reasonably have. All right. Today, I'm so excited by this panel. Folks, for the very first time on this show, we have a playwright, a TV and screenwriter. You've seen his work on Law & Order SVU, on American Soul, on so much more. Folks, I've had the pleasure of seeing this guy's work. I've had the pleasure of being side by side with him at a writer's retreat.
Yes.
He is the brilliant Azel Williams. Hey, Azel, how's it going?
Thank you for having me. It's going very well out here in LA, where we just pick one terrible Democrat to be our mayor, and that's it. That's how we roll. We don't do it twice. Are you kidding me?
Eventually, you too shall rank your votes. I hope, you know. We also have joining us for the not the first time, the multiplest time. Oh my God, this guy, he's so great. He's so funny. He's host of the Smartest Man in the World podcast. He's going to be on the road with Whose Line Is It Anyway in the fall. And also Whose Line Is It Anyway returns to the CW on Saturdays. It is, folks, none other than Greg Proops. Hey, Greg.
Hi, everybody.
Oh my gosh. Such a great panel. All right, let's get into it with topic number one. So I wanted to talk about police reform at the federal level. There's a couple of bills out there which may not have the political heft to pass Congress, but let's see what's on the table anyways. There's two main acts going on. There's the Breathe Act, which is like the more progressive option. It calls for the closure of federal agencies like ICE, like the DEA. It calls for divesting federal funds allocated to law enforcement. Mm-hmm. It includes federal grants to local governments to invest in public safety alternatives and pushing an end to mandatory minimum sentencing. There's the Justice in Policing Act, which this bill has actually passed the House. It centers on curbing qualified immunity protections for police officers. It makes it easier to prosecute police officers at the federal level and establishes a national registry of police misconduct. I guess my question for both of you, also now as we are a year after George Floyd, is which of these bills seem appealing to you? And also neither and both are also an option. And kind of where do you think we are with this? Like, what is the likelihood? Zell, we'll start with you.
I have never, ever in the past year or before ever thought any of these bills would ever get through. And I say this because, like, last year here in LA, you know, it became widely known that we spend about $2 billion every year on the police alone. And, you know, what I was saying before about our mayor, you know, he does kind of seem to be very good at, like, placating people, like saying, like, oh yeah, I'll make the changes, that's fine. And then we kind of step back and we forget about it. And then all of a sudden city council's like, oh, well, you know, they just had to get that money back because, you know, they have to deal with the homeless problem. And then they complain about dealing with the homeless problem. When you say things like, you know, well, let's take some of this money and get some more intervention counselors, some more social workers. They're like, whoa, 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 why do you want to take our money? And that's LA. And that's like, that's a city where it's like, you have to be a Democrat to run here. And because our Congress and our Senate is basically full of a bunch of Eric Garcettis in some way, shape, or form, who are going to like say what they need to say in order to keep the power structure in place, but are also going to try to look like they're going to do some progressive reform. I never really thought any of these bills would change. Like, it's insane to me that like we're talking about chokeholds as if the only reason police are choking people out is that they don't know that it's against the law. Like, they all know it's against the law.
Right.
You don't see these cops, like, pulling over, like, your grandma and being like, ma'am, quiet. It doesn't happen. And, like, they're making this choice to do it. So all of the reforms are kind of like these little piecemeal things that are the weakest sign of our society actually trying to control the arm of our society, of the government. And utterly, utterly failing. So I don't know. I just never really had hope that it would pass. I do think something does need to happen, because just frankly, as a society, we probably do want to show the rest of the world that our local law enforcement isn't just allowed to murder people if they choose to. But we haven't done that yet. So,
Greg, where are you at with this?
First of all, the idea that the cops are some benign organization that are here to look after us is a kind of an absurd notion to begin with, when that's really never been the purpose of the police. And they've been given way too much leeway in terms of what their bailiwick is. They have to look after homeless people. They have to tear down homeless encampments. They have to do all these things that, one, they're not psychologically prepared to do, nor are they even trained to do, nor should they have any hand in that at all. Like he said, LA, moving LA in one direction or another is like turning a giant oil tanker. We have 10 million people here. We're way too many cities. There's way too many entities within the city. Right now here, we have the sheriff's department and the police department fighting with each other over who can be the bigger Nazis. So we're having kind of an issue here in terms of like, we've overfunded these things for a million years. We've put in these people who, openly support white supremacy within the ranks of the departments. So to file all this down and get it changed literally is going to take, I think, several administrations. There's no changing it all at once. Having said that, I never try to look at the negatives, because I think In the last year since the police rioted,
I mean, I feel like you did a good job of laying out the negatives just now, though.
Well, I mean, he doesn't look at them, but they're so blatant.
They're there, but he's not looking. Okay,
like Raoul Peck says, we're looking for truth when we should be looking for meaning. Like, we all know the truth. The truth is the police and the sheriffs are a paramilitary force. One of their main jobs is to make sure that everyone in low-income communities is terrorized. So there's that truth. What is the meaning of this? The meaning is that within the last year, since we saw the police rioted right here where I live on May 26th, they set fire to their cars. They pretended Antifa did it or whatever. I mean, there's been a lot of performative police anger over the last year. And that's what the whole summer was about last year. The fact that there's two giant bills in front of the House is the most promising thing that's happened literally in 50 years. The idea that it got so bad, white people acknowledged it got bad. And when you get to that place where the general population of white people has to acknowledge that something's bad, now we're back to the 60s. Now we're back to where people actually, they weren't happy about it then either, but they're acknowledging it. And so I'd like to push forward that. And let's look at something else. The other day, Kamala Harris had a meeting, and this is a small tangent, and I'll let you get control of the show again, Nagin, had the Congressional Women in Senate dinner. And there were 24 women there and a couple missing. That's half the Senate. That never happened when I was young. We didn't have black vice presidents that were women when I was young. We didn't have 25 women senators when I was young. So I try to look at the big, big, big picture of America as the slow moving iceberg that it is and say, that's progress. However incremental it is, however much it doesn't affect your daily life, it really does affect your daily life. Because as you said at the top, Nagin, democracy is the long, boring, shitty process. Only autocracies move quickly, because autocracies don't need law.
True.
They don't need law.
Yeah, Right. No, I like that. I like that that reminder that there were no black vice presidents. There were no black vice presidents when I was young either. So I think that is a really good reminder to all of us. And no women. I want to, you know, I think you're absolutely right. The fact that there are two bills and that one of them even passed the House, and that they're even in bipartisan talks in the Senate of how to get the Justice and Policing Act, get something in the Senate. I think that is progress. That's a really great way of looking at it. I also think that, you know, there's sort of two, I would like to think of things in two tracks. I mean, I have a maybe 3% softer view of the police, having actually now been to multiple like precinct, you know, meetings and stuff like that, and being more involved in just like how policing operates in my actual neighborhood, and knowing more police officers than I ever did before. Like literally starting last summer, I was like, I need to know more. Who are these people? You know what I mean? And so that's kind of happened for me, which is soften my view a little bit just in terms of the, you know, neighborhood coordinating officers, what their goals are, how they're trying to do it, how they're trying to meet people. There is more of a community policing than I think I'd ever given them credit for. And maybe that's also a newer thing. So, again, I have like a 3% softer view, but that's not much, right? Because there's still that 97%. But I do think that there's two tracks to look at it on, which is that, which is one, reforming the police and the iceberg and the entrenched problems of the police and what we expect of them. And that's more like, will take some administrations, is a 5 to 10 year problem. And then there's the shorter term problem of there is actual crime and the pandemic has wrought a higher crime rate all across the board in the country. So I think like part of, you know, it's interesting because it was almost like if the, you know, marches of last summer had happened outside of a pandemic, I almost think we would have had one of these bills already. You know what I mean? But because the pandemic gave us a higher crime rate, I think it made some of these measures just less popular because people are like, no, I totally get the abstract notion of making all of these reforms, but literally there's more crime. So what are we going to do about that? So there's the short-term problem. And I kind of wish we could talk to people in a reasonable way of like, there's a short-term problem of crime, here's what we're gonna do. And there's the long-term problem of reform, here's what we're gonna do.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
Yeah, Zell.
I feel you on that, because like I have been struggling with this myself because my uncle, who is more of a father figure to me than an uncle, is retired police detective in Fresno, California. I love the man to death. He's the deacon of our church, the church I grew up in. My grandfather literally started. And we've had some
this
real
actually that like made me misty eyed. Just this description of your family.
Okay, oh no, I love ahead. Him. That's I really love
lovely.
Shout out Uncle Bill. I love him to death. That being said, we had some kind of hard conversations last year because like I grew up in, you know, Fresno, California. To tell you how, you know, like conservative that place is, it's where Devin Nunes is from.
So a lot of people hiding in bushes.
God, no, it's not. But like
that's a Devin Nunes deep cut.
I know,
from like 2017 or something.
Man does nothing for us, yet we keep sending the guys who own the farms actually keep sending him anyway. But like I love him to death, but you know, I went to school in the college in the Bay Area. I moved out to Chicago after college. I lived in New York for 6 years. I lived in Philly for 6 years, and I made some amazing friends who were educators and activists. And they saw collectively the use of the police force to like harass their students, harass the communities that they were in, like, I know community policing, there are, like you say, there are good cops and you do need to get to know them, but like, it is good to know them. But like, I had, you know, we had one of our talks about, like, you know, whether or not I believe that the all cops are bastards. And I said, like, look, not all anybody is bastards. But, you know, if you went out to the if you went out to any other country and were like, hey, how good are Americans? They're going to be like, a lot of them are probably going to say, like, oh, they're not that great. They seem to like to bomb us. Or they're going to say, like, that kind of thing. And I feel like when you look at, like, police forces, there is that kind of difficult thing you have to walk, where it's like the individuals, you know, or like your community police force, that's one thing. But, you know, as Greg was saying, even the history of the police force in this country, like what they actually are and what they do, like whether or not their first job is to like the community or whether their first job is to the landowning community, I feel like it's that nuance, it does get lost in this conversation, because so many people who have been under the strain of the police force just need change. And so, yes, they can see them all as bastards. And then there are people like you and me who, like, we have cops that we know who are cops in our family who are, like, good human beings. And it's hard for me to imagine. I can't, it's funny, like, seeing my uncle singing in the on a Sunday morning, like, Jesus is on the main line. It's hard for me to imagine him being, like, working somebody over with a billy club. So, yeah, right. It's those two things just don't align. And it's so hard to, like, have those type of nuanced conversations with people on the other side, because you want them to understand that, like, this is what this force is meant for me. Because whether or not they know my uncles are cop or anything, I leave this place, I'm a black guy walking on the street doing whatever I'm doing. And that, you know, that comes with a certain amount of baggage. If a cop pulls me over, I always feel terrified when a cop pulls me over. But, like, if I walk into a precinct with my uncle and, you know, retired detective, you know, Andrews says, like, hey, this is my nephew, it's a whole different other thing. Mm-hmm. And I think that is something we're going to have to get over. And I do want to say that, like, getting back to what Greg said, he's absolutely right. The fact that we have a conversation in the American public, at a federal level, I should say, in America, around whether or not we should do this is phenomenal. It kind of reminds me about, like, been doing a lot of reading about Thurgood Marshall for a lot of reasons right now. And people, you know,
I mean, who isn't?
Who, you know, you just summer read. Just like, you just sit on a beach and
read about
Thurgood's young days. But, you know, people act like Brown v. Board of Education was something he did. And it's like, that was a 15-ish year long journey that was started by his mentor. Wasn't even started by Thurgood. And along the way, a lot of black people were like, hey, why am I giving my NAACP all this money? They keep suing these school districts, right? They didn't see that, like, this was a longer plan. And I hope that this is sort of that. I hope that, God willing, by the time your daughter, or if I should be lucky, whatever, have kids or, but, like, I do hope that, like, by the time they come around, you know, it's so odd to them to think there was a time we allowed the police to just like pepper spray crowds.
No, I like that. And Greg closes out here on what should we tell people who say, but there's crime.
To be sure, those scared people
who are legitimately, who heard a gunshot, you know what I mean, last week, and they're scared. What do we tell those people?
We live in Los Angeles, and no matter what neighborhood you live in, there's murder, you know, and there's theft, and there's break-ins and all that. So I think that we have to come to terms with the vernacular and what the phrases we're using. Abolish the police is not a very accurate thing to say, nor is it really what we want. You don't want the police abolished. We want the police reformed. And so I hate to be the white liberal who urges moderation and patience, because I think Martin Luther King addressed that 1,000 years ago. I'm not. We all want change and we all want immediate change. But I would say legislation is a really good way to go. And Thurgood Marshall's an awesome example. His persistence in the face of this, my feeling is always there's too many people working too hard to make things better for us to start sniveling at any point. And that includes internal squabbling in the Democratic Party or whatever you want to call the left, because the other side really is a gigantic fascist outfit. And they're trying to control the narrative at all times. And they're trying to make us look like it's always we're socialists who don't want cops and we want anarchy. And that's not what's going on at all. Justice is a big part of this. And justice includes how the law enforcement behaves as well as how we behave. So to speak to crime, it went up because things are crazy. And then that goes back to the whole systemic social thing of there wouldn't be so much crime if people had stuff. So I can't even begin to address how do we topple the paradigm of billionaires and all that. But on a basic level, I'm hoping things are going to. The main thing is with having Biden and Harris in has for better, I think, turned the heat down on having everything coming from the very, very top of the country at an insane racist level bullhorn every second of the day, which allows us the space to have a discussion that's reasonably intelligent about crime, the cops and everything, as opposed to just having a sluice of misinformation.
Yes.
They're still doing
it. Oh my God, I can't even imagine this conversation the three of us would be having if Donnie was still in office. Oh, it would be a completely different story. I do feel like calmer talking about it right now. All right, folks, let me know what you think. I really enjoyed actually the optimism that both of you shared. That was a very Fake the Nation, we're only doing optimism thing that just happened. Folks, let me know what you think. I'm so curious. In fact, the New York City mayoral election has some interesting things to say about where people are on crime, because the leading contender who's gotten most of the votes now, which is just like in the low 30%, I think, is Eric Adams, who's basically running on a no, like we need to fight crime and not do it, you know, with no reductions in police force. So it's interesting. So what do you guys think? Let me know. Or think about it in your heads and then just send me your thoughts through the sky. Mm. It's another way of doing it as opposed to social media.
Good vibes.
All right.
Good vibes are the same as radio.
That's it for topic number one. And we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about other things. Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Also, discover more than 60 add-ons every week, like breakfast, on-the-go lunch, snacks, and beverages to help you stay fueled and feel good all day long. What are you waiting for? Folks, I feel like I've mentioned this before, but I tried other services that I was displeased with. And then a neighbor of mine was trying Factor. I had pulled them aside in the hallway and I was like, what are you feeling about this Factor? And they were like, it is delicious. You should definitely do it. So then me and my husband did it and we loved it. They are chef-prepared meals that arrive to your door, and then in 2 minutes, you could be eating them. Like, it's so simple, and they're actually delicious. And for people like me who just sometimes, my schedule can be so maniacal between traveling in different cities and, you know, doing stand-up gigs. It's like I just don't have a typical schedule where I can plan, set aside time for cooking and all that stuff. So something like Factor really helps for me. The other thing that I love to do is try not to eat carbs. So they have a keto option, which is fantastic. It's super delicious. They use premium ingredients. You can get stuff with like filet mignon and shrimp and truffle butter and broccolini and asparagus, right? Like real ingredients. They're no fuss, no mess meals. They eliminate the hassle of having to prep. They're tailored to your schedule. You can customize your weekly meals with flexibility. You can pause or reschedule. I've actually done that. I've both paused and rescheduled. Factor is basically your solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. We're celebrating Earth Day all month long, and look out for the Earth Month Eats badge on the menu for the lowest carbon footprint meals. So here's what I think you should do. I think you should head to factormeals.com/fakethenation50 and use the code fakethenation50 to get 50% off your first month plus 20% off your next month. That's code fakethenation50 at factormeals.com/fakethenation50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. I am the type of person that has subscribed to things and I have forgotten about those things. I have paid twice for a children's educational app, and I didn't know that I was paying twice for several months. Until that is, I discovered Rocket Money, and because I use Rocket Money, it just showed up all these things. The thing that I was paying twice for that made me incredibly angry, thank God Rocket Money ended that for me. It also cancels the subscription for you, so you don't have to like go through the hassle of going to that site and figuring out how to cancel. They actually make canceling very difficult. I don't know if any of you have had the experience, but I have been on a like a roundabout 8 exit nightmare trying to unsubscribe to something before. Rocket Money eliminates that hassle. It also alerts you to an increase in subscription price. And this is something Rocket Money did for me. It negotiates a lower price for something you already subscribed to. So like for my cable bill, it got me a lower price. And I was very happy about that. Nearly 75% of people have subscriptions that they've forgotten about, which makes me feel better because I'm one of them. But it makes me feel terrible because what are we doing? Losing that money. I don't want to waste that money. And I know you don't want to waste that money. If you struggle with these kinds of purchases, if you struggle with finances in general, Rocket Money will help you with the budgeting, help you track your expenses, help you, like I said, cancel those unwanted subscriptions. It's a personal finance app that finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions. It monitors your spending. It helps you lower your bills so you can get back to saving. I mean, me and my husband have been on the warpath, and Rocket Money has been a really big part of that. It has over 5 million users with over $500 million in canceled subscriptions. The average member has saved up to $740 a year using the app's features, which is, I mean, that tracks for me. So stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions. Go to rocketmoney.com/fakethenation. Again, that's rocketmoney.com/fakethenation. Save the money at rocketmoney.com/fakethenation. And we are back, and we're ready for topic number two. We're going to talk about how many friends you can have. In 1993, an anthropologist named Robin Dunbar said the average person could have a maximum of 150 friends, like actual meaningful relationships. This number is called Dunbar's number. But now, here's the big scandal in the world of friendship studies. There's a new study.
There's a world of friendship studies, first of all. Breaking news.
First of all, yeah. There's actual departments.
We used to call it drinking.
Yeah.
This one comes out of Stockholm. They say that you can actually have a ton more friends if you put effort into it. So first, I guess my question is, what do you think of Dunbar's number, 150 people? Do you think it's too low, too high? Where would you rank your own friendship capacities? Greg, where are you at on this? On this critical issue.
Well, I was looking at the topic before we came on, and it didn't make any sense to me whatsoever. It seems like it's completely conditional. If you live in a remote island in Norway, you're never going to have 150 friends. And if you live in the middle of Mumbai, it might be that you know every goddamn person on the block. So in any case, I think as you get older, in my experience, what I want isn't as much as more friends as a group of friends that I can depend on and trust that are the core of your emotional relationships. Because I'm a traveling ham, I know thousands of people in places all over the world. And a lot of them I'm very friendly with. Are they my friends? Yeah, when I see them, they are. And also, we've created 1,000 different like conditions of friendship now because, yes, for instance, I will consider Zell a friend after this. And if we see each other, we'll talk and acknowledge that we met each other and that you've met a million people over the last year because of Zoom and all the, you know, how many strangers mm-hmm. have you met? How many people have you contacted on social media? Da, da, da. So there's all these people I think I know fairly well that I don't think mm-hmm. I've ever spoken a word to. And then I do end up, because I travel around doing the podcast and whatnot, meeting them. And they'll go, I'm so-and-so. And I'll go, oh, you're so-and-so from Twitter. Or you're the one who wrote me in my email. So we do have mm-hmm. a relationship. So I don't know whether the number is as important as the connection. For me, being a comic, I always thought the most important thing was to connect with the audience. And then, of course, if they don't get you, to berate them. That's...
Audiences love that.
You know, like you're in a, this is so full, you know, now we're into metaphysics here, but when you're in front of the audience, you are their friend. Uh-huh. You're friendly with uh-huh. them. You're presenting yourself. Uh-huh. When you're writing for someone, the writing that they're hearing is your way of communicating with them. And the basic tenet of friendship is communication, right? And trust. Mm. If people trust you to give your opinion in front of them or trust you to tell jokes for an hour in front of them, then they're granting you a certain leeway within that perimeter of friendship and whatnot. So, but like mm-hmm. I say, sometimes I feel like I don't have friends because we've all been trapped for a year and a half and I start to go mad and my own paranoid delusions take over and then my sense of insecurity overwhelms my unbelievably unwarranted sense of confidence. Mm-hmm. And so that's when I pine for friendship. And then, you know, then you'll see a friend or talk uh-huh. to a friend and you'll remember all their horrible shortcomings and all the reasons they annoy you. And then you think, wow,
yes.
I've really got to let that balance out. I've got to be more, I have to, you know, practice more largesse to let people fail in my eyes. And then also, yeah. You know what I mean? Because heaven knows how people see me. I never think about it because I'm that self-centered. But I know that I'm annoying. I know that I'm sarcastic. I know that I'm selfish. I know that I can also be generous and kind, you know? So,
You know what's funny? I'm the opposite. I think everyone hates me. And that is something I have paid a lot of therapists a lot of money to help me to work out. And I also love the fact that, like, the people who invented IKEA furniture are like, you should work harder. This story for me was so... I love it so much.
And I know. Zell wrote me like in the middle of the night after having read this. Like, why were you so moved by this?
Because again, I was raised in a Christian household thinking I'm terrible garbage and Jesus doesn't love me because of it. And I'm working through a lot of that stuff. But seriously, I had the opposite thought, which is like, oh, I don't have a lot of close friends, and blah, blah, blah. I'm a product. I'm an old millennial. So like, I'm a product of this time where it's like half the people I know are like online only and half the people I know are like in real life. And then I had to come up with rules. Like I stopped engaging with Twitter because like every time I turned it on, it depressed me. And I came up with this rule of like, if I've never physically shook your hand, I'm not going to follow you on Twitter. That's just a thing I have now. But then I saw that this old number was 150 and that made me depressed in a whole other kind of way because I am just trying, if I had to keep up.
Oh my God. I feel like we're just watching, I've been witnessing the unraveling of both of you. Okay, go ahead.
I mean, because like, first of all, Nagin, so you have a little human who probably takes up a lot of your time. And whenever that happens with my friends, I've never seen them again. Like I don't see them at all again. And that's just, and it's not like we stop being friends, but it is a question of like, okay, so what kind of friends are we? Like, are we like work friends? Am I like I show up at the kids' parties, I guess, and I bring gifts. So like the biggest question for me in this story was like, what is a friend to these people? And then he described it as like someone you would say hi to in an airport. And I was like, this is bullshit.
Zell, you're forgetting the important part of that sentence, which is he described it as someone you'd run into in an airport without feeling awkward.
Which is no one. Which is literally no one for me. Like, I was bringing my dog inside of my building and I ran into the lady who lives across the hall from me. And I was so ashamed and could barely look her in the eye because I don't really know her. Like, are we friends? Like, if I saw her in an airport, I would hold my head down and pray to Christ. She did not see me. But like, I also think that we all happen to work in, we all happen to work in an industry, right? That kind of screws up friendships, because we all like, you want to, you work with your friends and you don't work with some of your friends, and you make things and you think like, oh, I can get here because I know blah, blah, blah. And it's like, well, that's not really a friendship. Is that like a work thing? So like, I feel like this data for me is questionable in the first place. I think you can totally know a bunch of people. I'll be honest, Greg. I'll tell you, I made an ass of, not an ass of myself, but I was just a nerd boy at Comic-Con a couple years ago when I met Aisha Tyler. And we were like at the Fox party, and I was like, oh my God, I love you. I love your stand-up, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. And Archie's great, blah, 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 blah. And like, I think now if I ran into her, she'd run away from me. We're not friends like that.
I'll tell her.
Like, that, but that's, wait, that's okay, what I'm so saying, though. Like, that's the world we live in, where friend is right. A friend is like, you know, what are you talking about? Like, did we grow up together?
I think that social media has made, you know, playwrights, artists, and comedians of everyone in the world, right? Like, because we're used to having these sort of like project-based public relationships, right?
Yes, yeah.
And now, because of social media, everyone has public relationships, right? That, you know, at different scales. Mm. And what I think is really hilarious about listening to both of you talk about this is that I've hung out with both of you socially. Zell, we were at a retreat at Vassar, at a writer's thing. And Greg, we were like at a weekend worth of shows in West Virginia. And so I got to hang out with both of you kind of off stage, and you're both incredibly social in very similar ways, except for Zell's perception of himself is so wildly different than Greg's perception of himself. But what's funny is like the manifestation of both of you guys is delightful, hilarious, and great to be around. Like, I would describe both of you that way. Mm-hmm. And so it's really funny that your reactions to this article were so different. And I think like, I don't know. I mean, of course, you read the number 150 and you read this ridiculous definition of like someone that you would run into in an airport and not be awkward. First of all, when I run into anyone, I first think, and this is because I'm a woman who learned from a very young age to hate myself, I think, what am I wearing? How do I look? If I run into someone unexpectedly, what am I wearing right now? How do I look? Am I wearing lipstick? What is the look? Like, people can't just see me be, I don't wake up like this, folks. You know what I'm saying? And so that's my first thought, because I'm so, so careful about what people think. So in that sense, running into someone at an airport it's not that it's awkward or not awkward. It's just fraught with like me and my sense of my outward appearance and my all of the insecurities I have around appearance from bred into me as a young little girl who was told to be try and be pretty, you know what I mean? And like that's, yes, I think the first thing. And so then you're like, are there 150 people that I could run into like wearing my pajamas and I wouldn't want, I mean, definitely that is not.
Brilliant. That is brilliant.
You know what I mean?
I think you're hitting on the important thing behind this, which isn't, it's not even so much the number, but it's like, how are we associating people in our lives? I think the element of gender that we socially train people to like believe in, what is, cause like guys don't, cis guys don't like often care. Like I am always amazed when I see like cis couples together, because I'll look at them and I'll be like, a woman works so hard to look good. She's wearing like a beautiful summer dress, and clearly she's like done makeup and taken a shower. And he rolled out of bed, put on the exact same sweatpants he wore yesterday, and could not give a fuck. And like, that's how we engage in the world. So like, even the genders have a different idea of like what friendship is and how you participate with someone in it. You know, I love the fact that this is such a cliche academic debate, because we have people who I can clearly tell, no offense scientist, they did not have a lot of friends growing up, and they're talking about like, well, this is what makes someone cool, your friend. And it's like, if you know that, it's like, dude, no. Like, and also, again, I just really want to stress, can you honestly say that any one of us wants to actually keep up with 150 of the people. Like, because I feel like that's okay, an important part of friendship, too. Say, it's like keeping up with people.
Okay, can I just say that my idyllic dream of not being like just super wealthy and sitting around and not working is that all I do is go and have like lunch and breakfast and dinner dates because I do keep up with 150 people. Like that's my extreme extroverts like dream is that is the yes, 150. That sounds great. I don't know if I have that right now or what, but like I think it would be amazing if I did, and I could just keep up with them. And that's what I would do as a non-working person.
Which goes back to Greg's point about like whatever society you grow up in, our society is capitalist. So before we can even have friends, we got to have the time. So we need the money.
That's right, right.
If you're working all day, you exactly. don't have friends you're busy.
Yeah.
Well, I love what Jill exactly. said too as well. And just to address that, because you brought it up, Nagin, I always dress up in public, and you've been around me. And,
you do.
And I rarely look together. And my wife always is really together. And, you know, yeah, it's a matter of...
I've also hung out with her, and she always looks amazing.
Oh, no. She wouldn't go out of the house in a baseball cap. I think she would rather, like, you know, jump into a lake. And so...
Yes.
On stage, I'm always in a suit and tie. And if you ever see me in public, I often will have a coat on and, you know, shiny shoes. And, like, I just can't be that guy that... wears the sweatpants and it looks like a slob. And I play in front of audiences, and sometimes I think it was Don Rickles who said, someone said people don't dress up anymore. And Don Rickles said, they come to the show in their underwear. And it's like, you know, there's that whole thing. Like you said, Nagin, the first thing I think of is what was I wearing when someone saw me? You know,
right.
Was my hair messed up? Was I wearing that horrible Czech shirt that I should have thrown away? but that's, you know, men have let themselves off the hook for literally everything, their behavior, their dress and all that. So being friends with a man is a completely conditional thing, because a lot of men have no boundaries and they're like, oh, we're friends, but maybe, you know, huh? Right. And you're like, no, gross. And so women don't really play that as hard as men do. Men are always like, the biggest emotional insult you can do to a man is to put him in the friend zone or whatever. Because now you don't desire him to be inside you or whatever. And it's like, when did we get to that as a measure of, you know?
Oh, my God.
So you only want to be intimate with me and share secrets in your life and eat together. And that's not enough for me. If I don't get everything I want, then I'm being relegated to some... You know.
I gotta stick it in. I gotta know that you want me to stick it in.
It's literally the only way. It's the only way I have value. Yeah. That's the only way I can.
Suddenly we're all actors. Because that's the only way actors can measure anything. Do you want to or do you not want to?
Folks, let me know if you measure your own self-worth by whether or not people want you to stick it in. But also, do you feel like you have 150 meaningful friendships? I don't know. Let me know all of the things that you want to let me know. Just let me know them. All right. Let us move on to topic number 3. Let's talk about critical race theory. And we're only talking about it not because I went to graduate school and studied it as a fucking nerd, but because Tucker Carlson's talking about it, you know what I mean? And they're banning the teaching of critical race theory in multiple states, which, what does that even mean? Also, when I was in kindergarten, we didn't have critical race theory, like, period. You know what I mean? It was mostly just, like, the alphabet and stuff like that. So I'm curious what exactly they're banning. Here's the funny thing. I've talked to some friends who just straight up don't even know what critical race theory is, which is reasonable, because maybe that means you didn't go to grad school for African American studies or sociology, or you didn't go to law school in which this came up as a legal issue. And that's fine. Most of us have not. So for those of you who don't know, it's basically that racism is not just embedded in people's like personal behavior, but also in institutions. So think of, for example, redlining from the 30s or something. Redlining was a policy where they would take whole neighborhoods that had Black people in them and say, we're not going to loan money to those people. That was a form of, you know, institutional racism. And so critical race theory addresses stuff like that, where racism is embedded in the actual institutions. And systems by which we all live our lives. So, folks, why, Greg, is it a big deal now? Like, why? What's going on? What happened? I thought it would be cool if nobody ever talked about this outside of academia.
Well, you're absolutely right. It's a theory and a system of knowledge that legal people put together in the 60s and 70s to sort of address this. And what the Republicans have done is they've taken something that they vaguely heard of and they've whipped it into a false flag for their people who don't really read or research. They just know that they don't like things because they're told, like with Tucker Carlson is talking about it, you can be assured of two things, that he hasn't the slightest amount of knowledge of what it is, particularly, and two,
none whatsoever.
That if he did know what it was, he would still misinterpret it to everyone. Mm. Let's get to the basic bottom line on this. It's not taught in K-12. And the giant argument that all the Republican houses across the country and Republican governors are freaking out about is that they don't want children to ever be taught that a white person could have a racist impulse. And that somehow the critical race theory impugns all white people and makes us all racist from the get-go. And gosh darn it, that's not fair. And I won't have my kindergartner taught that. As you pointed out, when I was in kindergarten, we were taught that the pilgrims invited the Indians to a banquet. So the idea that it's being taught at any level other than the highest levels of education is nonsense. So it is just like so many things, like abolish the police, like Antifa, like calling Black Lives Matter a terrorist organization. It is an absolute falsehood. They have no more idea what critical race theory is than they have about fornication. They simply want to use another red flag to wave in front of their absolutely racist base who voted for 45 and all the down ballot people for the simple fact that they know that they will uphold racism. And so I think that's what they're using it for. It's a media football. They also can count on the mainstream media at all times giving both sides equal weight. Instead of saying they're voting for fascism over and over again, they just go, well, Republicans are very resistant on the voters. And then with the critical race thing, they go, Republicans are upset over. So did you hear Governor Ricketts of Nebraska, the one who his main accomplishment is letting people die in meatpacking plants during COVID? And his brother owning the Cubs. They asked Governor Ricketts why he was so upset about critical race theory, and he gave one of those fabulous Republican answers. He said, socialism? When was America even vaguely socialist? I mean, other than Social Security, things like that. I don't know, streetlights. Those are good things that are socialist. And he just blathered on. So they don't know what
buzzword.
It is.
Scary buzzword.
Well, they don't. I mean,
they want school board meetings to be disrupted by ugly people. Is what they want.
They want
school board meetings to be flooded with other people screaming at the top of their voice over shit they know nothing about.
But also, I should point out, Zell, in terms of those school board meetings, there has been legislation outlawing critical race theory in schools passed in Idaho, Iowa, Oklahoma, and Tennessee. And there's proposals in other state houses as well. And the funny thing to me is, like, what is that even... I mean, what do you understand that to even mean?
Exactly. Yeah, no, like, you're absolutely right. Because, like, it's funny because, like, I did not study, critical race theory as a topic in college, but, like, I grew up in a Black family. So, like, my grandfather
So let me guess, your first words as an infant were critical race and theory.
Exactly. Like, we just, that's all you teach Black children to say at first. And then, of course,
and then mama, and then dada, yeah.
No, but, like, I didn't study it, but I did grow up in the Bay Area. And correct me if I might be wrong about this, but I believe critical race studies started at San Francisco State, my maternal grandfather's alma mater. And When I got to college and, you know, I was able to take my electives in history and everything. I took African-American studies. So I sort of got a little bit out of there. But it's just like it is literally what the words say. It is a critical look at race in this country. And that's, as Greg was saying, that is what is terrifying to them. Because if you at all question whether or not America is the greatest, best place that has ever, never, ever done anything wrong, well, then you're a socialist commie who needs to, like, go back to, like, Russia and with your Bolshevism. Like, it's literally all just buzzwords that they're throwing out. And, oh, by the way, as you say, these laws that they're passing in schools, we're not teaching it to children.
So it's dumb.
So there's nothing there. It only looks like they're doing something. Like, that's what it looks
right.
like. It's a word. Right. It's a word that Tucker Carlson can say to, like, throw out to his base so that they obsess over, like, stopping critical race theory. Meanwhile, the rich people aren't going to pay taxes. You're going to pay taxes. Like, they're not going to help your schools. God forbid. In fact, this is a great way for them to take even more money away from public schools if they want to investigate this. You know, my example of this, and I remember this distinctly because, again, I was raised in a very Christian household. So I was forced to go to church and I was not happy about this on Sundays. But I remember distinctly second grade being taught about manifest destiny. And like, it was like a record scratched in my brain because I had this white lady telling me that, like, oh yeah, no, the reason America is coast to coast is because God wanted it that way. And I'm being dragged every Sunday at a real church, by the way. I'm talking like 9:30 a.m. to 2 o'clock. I'm talking football hours.
Oh, shit. Yeah,
football
yeah.
on the West Coast, which means that games start at 10.
Niners. Yeah,
there you go. Steve Young, baby. That was my era. So like, I'm hearing this for the first time and I'm just like, wait, the God I go to every Sunday told a bunch of white people that they could have this land, just murder the hell out of anybody who was here because he wanted it. And that for me on a personal level, I remember distinctly in my brain being like, it was the kind of the first thought of me being questioning both Christianity and questioning both the American mythos. And, you know, I had parents who were telling me about things like my paternal grandfather came from Tulsa, Oklahoma. So I knew about the Tulsa riots all of my life. It's not a huge surprise to me.
Right.
That what this is basically they're trying to marginalize thought of people of color. Because if you are white, and if you have grown up in this country, you have this lovely story that you're allowed to tell, which is that your family came from Europe and they had no money and they didn't require any help whatsoever. And they had $3 and all of a sudden they built some wonderful corporation that is the reason that you now and your children never have to work. Never have to work. And that's fine because that's what God wants it. Prosperity gospel, lovely. Meanwhile, if you're brown and you're from this country, you often are telling the story of we did not want to come here. Or we were forced to come here, or we had to come here literally because it was either this or dying in back where we come from. Mm-hmm. And then we got here and we've struggled and we've kept together and we're alive. And every step of the way that we fought to get the little bit that we had, these were the hurdles that were put up for us by the system that this country has in place, whether it be redlining, you know, whether it be like systemic racism and other forms of life. That's what it is. And that is what is terrifying to them, because if you question that, you have to question, well, is it right that we have all of this land? Is it right that we walk past all these homeless people in this town without really giving a care? Is it okay that I am able to afford to send my kids to a school where they will get a very good education? Well, they will have a 5-person class where they talk about Russian literature. Meanwhile, down the street, they can't afford desk. Mm-hmm. Like, that is what critical race theory makes you question. And that's what they're afraid of. They're afraid of their audience actually waking up and thinking about that and facing that truth. So,
and you know, the thing is, though, so this is how they're able to rouse fears. And I'm curious if you could put yourselves in the shoes of people who are receiving the Tucker Carlson discourse.
You mean my cousins?
Greg, specifically your cousins is who I'm referring to. Yes. You know, basically they're saying that the theory advocates discriminating against white people in order to achieve equality. And I wonder, so for people, so, okay, you're a poor white working class person and you're hearing about critical race theory and you're hearing about your privilege. I can see how that would be frustrating, because you're like, how am I the beneficiary of anything? Mm. I am also poor.
Yes.
Right? And so, Greg, like, what do you say, you know, to your cousins or this hypothetical, you know, poor white person who doesn't feel like they're the beneficiary of anything?
Mm. Well, as they always say, the fish doesn't know that it's surrounded by water. And white people don't know that they're buoyed by privilege, even at the poorest level. I've been doing stand-up comedy for 174 years. And every time I bring it up to the white people in the audience that it might be that they already have an advantage from the starting blocks, the anger of white crowds is a pretty wild cloud of wrath. They don't like to hear it. They don't like it inferred. They don't like to hear that the police are racist. I remember playing in Kansas City right after Ferguson and talking about cops and whatnot and saying that I don't remember any young black men ever planning a war against Iraq, or I don't remember any young black, you know what I mean? I don't really get that young black men are this evil force that are ruining my life. But they went quiet every time. And I'd go, so them, certainly you've heard of Ferguson. Right. And they'd all go and hang their heads. They know. They've been new. Like I said, there's what the truth is and there's what we want to derive from the truth. So the most important thing is to always keep dialogue flowing. And education and sunlight really are the best disinfectant. Part of the reason they've leaned on CRE so hard is, and I call it that now, or CRT, is that they lost with the George Floyd movement. They lost. All of a sudden, white people were sympathetic, or a bunch more became sympathetic. And that scared the shit out of them. So they had to think of something that is irrelevant, that's literally irrelevant to everyone's life, that's not an academic, as you say, because it wasn't going to be taught to you until you were in school for, what, 14 years? So, and that's what they've done, I think. So I always try to, like, just... You have to keep things simple for a lot of people because they don't have a lot of information coming into their lives, and they often don't know how to parse the information they get. They can't think laterally because they haven't been taught to think laterally. They can't think empathetically because it hurts them, literally hurts them. As James Baldwin said, they'd have to let go of their pain.
Yeah. Which is ironic because critical race theory would help you learn that.
Well, no question. I mean, I love demonizing someone like the woman who writes as Ida B. Wells, Hannah, who put together the 1619 Project, which is, if you've read it or looked at it at all, it's magisterial. It's a real beautiful recapitulation of history. It's not at all easy, and it's extraordinarily painful and horrible. But it's not that you have to dwell in the painful and horrible every moment. It's that you have to realize it, acknowledge it, and then incorporate it into what you know and then move on. But that's where the crux is, I think. They don't want to acknowledge it. They don't want to realize it. And they don't want to move on. And because they know that, you know, I'm old and I don't want to live forever. But I would like to live another 20 years only so I can see how different things are going to be in 20 years. Because you really will have all of the Lindsey Graham, Mitch McConnells and all that.
Yeah.
You will see the Josh Hawleys of the world marginalized because literally demographics are not on their side. And so this is a flailing of the dinosaurs here. It really is. Now, mind you, they have all the money, so that's a bummer. But
that's probably. Can I also add to that? I would always say to them that you cannot talk about critical race theory without talking about critical economic theory. Hmm. So if you are broke and white in this country, and it's so funny because I have this book, Battle of Blair Mountain, because all I read is lighthearted rom-coms, apparently. and it's about a mine worker strike in West Virginia, like in 1900s. And it's about literally the federal and state government sending in Pinkertons to crush white people. I guarantee you white people, like just all white people, white on white crime just cannot stop. And if you are poor and you are white in this country, you should know literally anytime they're talking about critical race theory as a problem, they're trying to get you to not look at the fact that they are screwing you over, that you should, you too are as much a victim of this system as the black and brown communities that have been trying to understand how they got there via the study of critical race theory. So you should understand that you can't talk about, like, in this country, we live in a capitalist society. So when we talk about people having privilege, we're basically talking about you having money, right? Like, and if you are, you know, there is, if you have the ability to marry within a family without it becoming like a visible thing, i.e. you marry rich, now you're all of a sudden part of a different part of a different group. And that's something that literally can't happen if you look different, because your children will also look different. It's that's one of the elements about critical race that you're talking about. But like, if you're looking at your society and saying, well, but I can do those things because I am white and like I didn't do anything wrong to cause this problem, you should understand that you got a friend in critical race theory, because you're all looking at exactly how is this power being kept from you? How is this privilege being kept from you? And the people who want you angry are probably also the people who want you poor. Like, that's always the case. Mm-hmm. And it is frustrating. So like, to them, I would say,
that, by the way, is, can that just be the title of your next play or something? The people who want you angry are also the people who want you poor. Well, it's a long one, but I think you could rock it.
My next play is called brilliant. Diversity, so I don't really fuck around on the titles. So don't worry. I think that is so important to understand when you're having this conversation, that critical race theory. Look, if literally black people woke up tomorrow with everything flipped, like black people all of a sudden had the wealth of white people in this country and they had the wealth of like the standard of living that black people had, I bet you there would be some dynamic changes in power around here. And it would be so much easier to understand if you could just flip a switch that easily. You can't. So you need to understand that critical race theory is also critical economic theory. And if you are broke and if you don't understand how these things affect you, it's because you're focusing on your whiteness. And if you can't let that go, like in your mind, in some way, you're thinking like, well, but I should be on top because I'm like a white man in this country and blah, blah, blah. And it doesn't work out for me. And if you're getting angry at poor people who like are way overrepresented, people of color are way overrepresented in the poor in this country, well, then you're focusing on the completely wrong aspect. You're not robbing the bank to get rich. You're robbing the poor to stay poor, basically. So I think that the thing for them to remember is that they don't want you looking at them. That's why they're telling you to fear critical race theory.
Yeah. Folks, beautiful last words there from Zell. Thank you so much. That's brilliant. You guys, that's the end of the show. Thanks so much for joining me. That was a wonderful discussion. And I would love for the people of Fake the Nation to be able to follow you and all the stuff that you do. Zell, where do they do that?
Oh, you can find me on Twitter and Instagram, occasionally on Twitch. Like I said, if I don't know you in person, I'm probably not going to follow you, but I throw some stuff out there. You can find at Azel Will. That's where I am. You can find my website, azelwill.com, with more information on my life, including my new play, Diversity, which is going to be part of Ojai Playwrights Conference this summer, August 7th. Go to ojaiplays.org to find out more, and you can have the theater brought to you until Broadway opens up again.
And also, subscribe to the podcast, Inner Cities.
Oh, my
podcast.
God. Yes. Also subscribe to the Inner Cities podcast, where two black men talk about politics and culture and how we survive, with former Fake the Nation guest, Tochi Onyebuchi.
Yeah. And he'll be on again, Tochi.
Yes. So, and we are, by the way, we're taking our mental health break right now. So like, we'll be back soon, but you can follow and check out what we've done thus far.
And Greg Proops, where do people find you?
You can find me on Twitter at Greg Proops. I'm on Instagram. I think it's G Proop Dog. I have the podcast. There's a new one out the other day. You can get that at gregproops.com. Usually I do it with my wife. We'll be recording one this weekend. I'll be back on the road in October with Whose Line Is It Anyway? Who's Live Anyway show with me, Joel Murray, Ryan Stiles, and Jeff Davis. That's in October. You can go to whoslive.com. The TV show Whose Line Is It Anyway? Is in its 725th great year. We started when television was powered by steam. Aeschylus wrote the first suggestions for us. And so we'll be back, as we like to say, some of these jokes are in their 50th great year. And that'll be on the CW coming up and on. But please, I'll be back on the road again, hopefully as a stand-up comic and improviser in the autumn, because we're going to be super cautious about this. And so gregproofs.com is where it's all happening. I don't really sell a lot of products And the podcast is free to download. I have a Patreon page and all that jazz too, if you want to get crazy.
Get crazy, guys. And folks, you know where to find me, but I would really love to thank all the people that make this show a possibility. That's our wonderful producer, Julia Linden, our fantastic sound engineer, Stephanie Aguilar, and all of the great, beautiful people at HeadGum that make this show possible. Our theme music was written by Gabi Alter. And as always, please rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts because it really does help people find the show. Email us at fakethenation@headgum.com. Join me on Patreon for bonus content and so much more. You can do that at patreon.com/NagineFarsad. And otherwise, we'll be back in your earballs next week.
That was a HeadGum podcast.